Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Trash Mix Podcast. And today we have a special guest, and you've probably seen him around LA, probably seen him around DOC, maybe Texas.
Out in the Dino.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah. And it's none other than Mike Aguirre of See It on 16mm.
What's up, everyone? How y'all doing?
Tell everybody who you are, what you do, exactly.
My name is Mike Aguirre. I run something called See It on 16mm. This all started, I'm about to hit my 5 year of touring and doing this, but basically bringing film prints to theaters that don't have film anymore. This kind of all started because I was commuting a lot to like Central LA to hit up some of the theaters to watch stuff on film, and I noticed like a lot of the theaters outside of Central LA like really don't show film anymore. So it was like one of those things where I was like, how do you kind of bridge that gap so people can experience watching a movie on film? And, you know, thanks to Trevor, Frida Cinema was able to start playing it in theaters and started working with other theaters. So I've been doing this for, next month is going to be 5 years now.
So basically, Frida and Trevor were responsible for this.
Yeah.
Yeah. Shout out to Trevor. Yeah, man, that's awesome. The dude right there.
It happened. I think it was a Father's Day during the first year of the pandemic. He came over and we watched a double of Rolling Thunder and Death Wish on 16 in my backyard. And he was like, hey, would you want to do this at the theater? And I think it did like a member screening. And then we did the first like public screening in December 5 years ago now.
What the fuck? Do it again.
Yeah.
Rolling Thunder?
Fuck. Yeah, it was a sick double. The print was faded as hell, but like also the print was missing like 40 minutes. And the movie was like under an hour and 20 minutes, the print that I found in San Diego, and it just kind of got to the point and it kind of cut out all the
good shit.
It was all the good shit, but it cut out the relationship. So it literally went from him losing his hand to him going to dinner with Tommy Lee Jones. Like, it cut that much out, but it was sick.
Yeah,
thank you, Trevor, for everything, man.
Well, we have you on here because we're talking about a special 16mm print that you and Armando kind of have a little bit of a history with this print, because you guys have now screened the print of the movie that we're going to be talking about a couple of times already. So you want to go a little bit about that, Armando? You started.
Yeah.
Mike, you can chime in.
Yeah, I actually pointed it out to Mike. What was the guy's name that we got the print from? The first print?
The first print was found in, I believe it was in New York, and it was my buddy Evan.
Yeah, Evan. Yeah, he has a sick collection.
Evan had the print, and he offered it up, and Armando and I were just like, yeah, let's pick it up. Like, you know, a lot of Mexican films and stuff showing up on 16, it just really doesn't happen much. So it was one of those things where it's like, you know what, let's go through with this. Let's start screening this.
Kind of a no-brainer to pick it up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually really liked that movie too. I was like, oh, fuck, I remember this movie. Because I've seen it on TV like a lot, like growing up. I was like, oh, shit. And it's an English version, which I've never really seen before.
Yeah, there's like we'll get into that, you know, version of it, because there are two. There's an English version and a Spanish version, and we're going to kind of review the English version just to kind of keep it, you know, in the context of the movie that people have seen you guys screen. Mikey, tell us, what's the name of the movie?
100 Cries of Terror from 1965. This was... I had not seen the movie until I told Armando about this print, and he was like, oh, we need to get this. Like, this is actually like really good. And learning that it was basically a two-part anthology, it was fantastic. Like, we've had such a blast. We now have we bought another print of it. Another print came up from an old rental house that we found about a year ago, and it was a little bit better condition. And we're just, you know, we've been touring the print around. We did a quick screening in LA, and then we showed it again in at the Texas Theater. We actually, like, I don't know if you remember that, but we flew out with the projector and everything. And the
I remember getting stopped at TSA because they were like, what the fuck is this bomb that this fool's trying to bring on this fucking plane?
It was it was awesome. I literally tried packing it up and they literally dismantled the entire package that I was trying to bring on the plane, but it made it there and we were able to screen it. And then we just recently had a screening at a Philosophical Research Society in Los Feliz, and
it felt pretty appropriate there, actually.
It really did. yeah, like if there was one movie that, because we have like what, just a couple prints that we can screen of some of these Mexican films on 16. So it was that movie. I was like, oh, this is gonna fit very well. And I think everybody that showed up, they were pretty stoked on it for the most part.
Yeah, a couple of people that I knew that went, they were like, yeah, that was really good. I never seen it.
Yeah,
they were excited to see that one.
And it's been like, I think this is like honestly probably the best you can see this movie, because everything else that I've been seeing has been like really shitty, like VHS rips.
Yeah, very grainy.
Audio's
kind of eh.
Yeah.
Even like when we start breaking down the stories and stuff, like the audio clips, I went through. I have the Spanish version on my hard drive in my digital archive, but the audio is so fucking bad.
Is it that bad?
It's really bad. I spent like maybe 3 days trying to fix it, and it just and there was like no depth in it. When I, you know, it was like you try to take the highs out to kind of eliminate the background noise, like the static, but it would just completely drown out, and it was just bad. So I even told Armando, like, yeah, even the clips that we're gonna play for the movie in this episode, it's gonna be the English version, unfortunately. But you know, it is what it is. It's the best quality version that I have, at least. Yeah,
because I saw some of the rips on YouTube. I was just curious, and I was like texting Armando during it. I was like, is this really the best it looks? Like, it was like this grainy, washed out, contrasty, kind of choppy type of video. And I'm like, this is pretty bad. Like, and it's just, I'm just glad people were able to see it like this, because the print looks fucking great. And I thought it looked really nice on the big screen.
So which version did the people in Texas see? Because I was, you know, obviously I was there at that one. Was that, yeah. Is that the, because you said you had two different prints of this now at one point?
Armando and I, we had an original print. This, okay, so that one, the one that was at Texas Theater, it was the first print that we had.
Yeah, that was the first one.
Okay. Yeah, and thank you to everybody at Texas Theater for allowing us to do that, Chad, and Hope setting us up with everybody there. We really appreciate it and hope to go back to Texas soon. Yeah, that print was the first one. And then, so I did a buyout of like a bunch of old rental films right here in Eagle Rock at a storage unit. And I texted Armando and I was like, they have 100 Cries of Terror in this buyout. I bought about like almost 100 16mm films from this buyout. And I just literally, the guy opened the storage unit and the box was right there literally looking at me, and it said 100 Cries of Terror. And I'm like, no fucking way. I was like, no way, dude. And like looked at it and it was actually in better condition than the first one. So,
I mean, you know, why not get a second print? Yeah. The movie itself is good. But, you know, you bring up an interesting point, or I guess we were kind of talking about it a little bit, because there's two, there's the Spanish version and there's the English version. And obviously you guys have the English dub. But that was created by K. Gordon Murray, who was kind of like a I don't want to use exploitative producer, but that's kind of what he was, because he would take you know, especially Mexican movies, he would take Mexican movies and redub them into English, retitle them, and then just kind of release it into the masses for the American audience. So
yeah, he was very gimmicky. So he worked with Kroger Babb. If you don't know who Kroger Babb is, he was an exploitation filmmaker. So he learned a lot from Kroger. So he was pretty schemey and weird like that.
Yeah, anyone who's seen the VCI versions of the Santa movies that they put out on that box set where they keep calling them Samson, that was
The black and white ones. Gordon Murray. Yeah, that was Gordon
production.
Yeah. Oh wow. Okay.
Yeah. They did him in Miami because that's where he was based at the time. So he would just hire a bunch of random actors and do him in Miami.
Yeah, I read a little bit of an interesting story about him because I guess he was like a carny in the 30s when he was kind of like growing up, and then came to Hollywood in the 40s, worked with Cecil B. DeMille.
Literally all the weirdos learned trades from him
and then moved to Florida and was like, fuck it, let's release these movies. And
he dabbled in the porn industry a little bit too, right?
I believe so, yeah.
I think there was something on the Rialto Report that they were talking about. Kay Gordon was like a producer that was like involved in some of the stuff that was happening in Miami. And the dude, they were saying he was just very smart with the way that he executed stuff. And like, but like, geez, like some of the stuff that he did put out, like, is just... you know, you see it still kind of pop up these days, like, you know, with like Sinister Cinema and all the stuff that they used to release. And then, you know, it was mainly all the Kay Gordon Murray stuff. So, it's awesome. I'm glad that people were able to see some of this stuff. But man, I wish the quality was a little bit better on some of these.
Yeah. I mean, I would imagine that some of these prints are either non-existent at this point or just, you know, extremely scarce to find. But it would be dope to find some of these. What do you think? Do you think he was really, I mean, I'm sure he released the majority of these on a 35 millimeter print, but I mean, obviously you have 16 millimeter prints of his work. So what do you think would have been like the comparison between a 35 and a 16 millimeter print, or as far as like, you know, how he was releasing these movies?
I honestly think I've seen a majority of them, because like you don't really see much of the 35s of these. I think these were just all kind of like duped and like sent out to be played for like television stations and stuff like that, and like and everything that he basically like was doing, it kind of seemed for like smaller type of things like in-home or something like that, or like I said, running for television. It didn't seem like there was really, I have not come across much of like actual like 35 stuff from that. And then most of the 16 prints, I would even say with the 100 Cries of Terror print that we have, that it's just a really good dupe from possibly like a 35 or something like that, because it you can tell some of the differences that it's like that with contrast stuff, where it's like, it, this is not an original, but it's actually a really nice dupe of an original print.
Well, he wasn't the king of the kiddie matinees for nothing. I mean, I read that the Rene Cardona movie that he put out, the Santa Claus, that was like one of his only movies that was successful and ran theatrically for 3 decades. He was able to make money off of that fucking movie.
And then the Mexican producers, the Calderon family, they didn't even know who he was. They didn't even know that was going on. They literally had no idea who the fuck that. They didn't even know who that was. They're like, who the fuck is that? Like, they had no idea who that was. They never like authorized it. So, you know,
I mean,
you already know.
Yeah, you know, that's the nature of the business, especially at that point, right?
Just fucking,
But let's kind of get into it. Obviously, you guys know by now we're talking about 100 Cries of Terror, a.k.a. Cien Gritos de Terror from 1965. I actually really like this movie a lot. I'm sure the people who came to see it at some of the screenings that you guys have had probably like it a lot too.
Yeah, everybody that I know that came to see it at any of the screenings that we did, they all had pretty positive things to say. There was never one like, oh, it was just okay. They were like, no, that was actually really good.
I think that stems from the fact that, you know, so the director, his name is Ramon Obon, but he was primarily a writer. This is his only movie that he ever directed.
That was literally the only one, yep.
And then on top of that, he had two cinematographers that were super well established. Yep.
And it shows too.
That's one of my the key notes that I have written down here, was some of the shots in some of these movies. But let's kind of go into Ramon a little bit, because like I said, he was mainly a writer. He actually wrote the Enmascarada de Plata, which would, you know, we talked about a little bit in the Santo episode about being, you know,
that's like the precursor of Lucha films.
Yeah, like, yeah. I guess technically would be the first, you know,
attempt at a Santo Lucha film. Movie. An attempt at a Santo film, sort of.
Yeah. El Vampiro, you know, everybody absolutely knows. Legendary, Golden Age Mexican horror. El Ataúl del Vampiro, another, you know, legendary.
The sequel.
Misterios de Ultratumba, which to me, I
that one is really good.
Love that movie.
Yeah, that one's really good.
Hopefully we'll talk about that one, you know, somewhere down the line.
And then he did El Pantano de las Animas, which is like a kind of a horror western. It has like a Gill Man, quote unquote.
I gotta watch that. Yeah. I haven't seen that one.
Well, a spoiler alert, it's not really a Gill Man, but yeah.
I didn't think it would be.
That was one that Kay Gordon also did a dubbing of as well.
Oh, so it's out there then.
Yeah.
It can be mentioned too on the El Vampiro set that Indicator put out. They actually talk about the 100 Cries of Terror screening that we did at the Texas Theater.
Yeah, Abraham Castillo Flores. Yeah, he mentioned it to Ramon Obon's son about that. He's like, oh, he thought that was pretty cool. And he does mention that in the Blu-ray feature.
Yeah, the marquee and everything.
We gave him like a copy of the clip and everything and like the marquee.
So you take notes. If you haven't bought that box set, man, go out and get it.
If you really want to learn more about Ramon Obon, you got to get that Blu-ray.
It comes with both movies, doesn't it?
Puan del Vampiro, so it comes with both movies and then a really good like little feature on Ramon Obon.
Yeah, shout out to Abraham, man. What a fucking dude. Yeah. So basically, it was produced by Antonio del Castillo, who also produced, you know, El Mascarado de Plato, but... One of the standouts for me, and I don't know how you guys feel about it. I mean, obviously, by now, hopefully people know that kind of my background with Rendezvous in the soundtrack, movie soundtracks and all that stuff. But the soundtrack to this movie was fucking amazing. It's like
jazzy.
Super jazzy. I mean, it's like, you know, anything coming out of the U.S. at that time, you know, is comparable to what Rafael Corrion was doing. And he also did the music to another movie that we talked about, the Caminos de Michoacán, which I guess I don't really remember.
Like, he like composed it, and then like a lot of his old stuff got played later in the 80s, like in Violador Inferno, like Inferno Rapist. Literally the same music in this movie is played in that one.
See, so I mean, again, everything is a tie.
Yeah, they were just recycling the music.
So yeah, let's get into the first story. I mean, it's two, the movie, it's one thing that I really like about anthologies is kind of how movies tie into one another, but I feel like this one doesn't really have like that thread between them. It's just two horror stories. One is more supernatural, and I guess the other would be kind of like a
psychological
betrayal. Yeah, like a betrayal. There, well, even like the second story is kind of like an existential like horror movie, you can say, kind of the crisis and dilemma that this fool is going through. But the first movie is like a betrayal for sure. I guess the cautionary tale of don't try to, you know, two-time your wife, you know, because she's probably gonna find out. The first story is called Panico, and I do want to point out that, you know, the cinematographer on this, absolute legend, Agustin Martinez Solares, and if that name sounds semi-familiar, it should.
That's the brother of Gilberto Martinez Solares.
Exactly.
Yep. Adolfo, our friend Adolfo's uncle.
Shout out to Adolfo. If you haven't listened to that interview, go back and listen to that. Absolutely legendary camera work there. Dude has 161 credits, worked with the greats, like you said, Gilberto Martinez Solares, his brother, worked with Chano Urueta, who, if you don't know Chano Urueta, like, at this point, turn this off and go watch some Chano movies.
The funny thing is, too, Agustin, he had also had, like, his kids in the movies, too, if you never noticed that.
Well, that's another thing that I have pointed out here, because his son... Mm-hmm. Agustin Martinez Solares Jr., pretty famous. I think anyone who showed up to the Santo Sunday series that you guys programmed at the Frida would remember him as Rufus Rex. Yep.
Rufus,
you
know, Rex.
The sexy wolf man. And if you haven't seen that, you know, please go see that, because that's fucking a banger. But he was all, you know, tons of movies, Night of the Bloody Apes and all kinds of other shit. But His work in this movie, I mean, I don't know. I would assume that this movie was shot on set and not at an actual location. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure you guys would agree with that.
Oh, yeah, you could tell right away.
But the way he was able to make this big-ass house feel small with the way he was working the camera, can't go unsaid, because, I mean, there's like a gothic feel to this movie. Inside the movie, it's such a weird like juxtaposition, because it's like the interiors almost feels like an Art Deco style mansion. It's like super dark in there though, so it kind of has this weird gothic feel, and just the way, like I said, the way he's playing with the camera just really kind of lends into the story with how you know, all the intricacies of the room and the stairwells and shit like that.
Yeah, it felt very like, I felt like the backdrop for this movie was like very like Spanish gothic type of like architecture and stuff too. Like I felt like the house was like a character in its own, especially in this first segment.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I mean, they almost kind of allude to it, you know, yeah, with the kind of the background of the house being kind of this, you know, haunted house. Yeah. And, you know, whether or not that's a true story, I mean, I would imagine the husband was lying. But yeah, the house really does play an integral role in the story itself.
I don't understand.
You don't understand what?
Just why this house turned out to be so cheap.
The owners had sentimental reasons. I bought it from the heirs of the old lady who built it originally. They didn't want to live in it. It brought back unpleasant memories. The owner was the grandmother, but died 6 years ago. And since then, no one's wanted to live here. I don't know. Seems it was a tragedy in the family. I was told that her husband and the three children were fatally injured in an accident. Of course, she continued to live on here for 10 years, all alone in this great big house. But the woman didn't think well.
Crazy?
Sure. Crazy.
But let's get into it. I mean, really, there's only three players in this first story. Joaquin Cordero, who, again, absolute legendary Mexican actor. Well over 200 credits. We've talked about him. He was part of the first two Santo movies.
Yeah, he's been in a lot. Like he deserves more credit than he gets, I feel. Like there's so many actors like from his age, you know, they get more credit than they should get. Joaquin, it's like he's been in more stuff than these other legendary actors.
Well, why do you think he's overlooked then?
I think it's like just like the favoritism, you know, that's what it is. You know, Joaquin stars in these, like, you know, cheesy little movies, but it's like, no, he's done better shit too, you know? Yeah, like, he deserves more credit than he gets, you know?
Because he was in more, like, the pulpy sci-fi.
Yeah, I think that's what it is. Yeah, but I always said, like I said, no, he did better. He did more than the other guys, I feel.
He's a phenomenal actor, yeah, too. I've never seen a role that he's been in that he...
Very charismatic and very serious, and then if he needed to be funny, he was funny. So yeah, he was a great actor. I don't know why he doesn't get more accolades, you know, or anything like that. It amazes me.
Well, I mean, we'll shine some light on, you know, some more light on his career. But he plays a character named Julio, or in the English version, his name is Howard.
Howard.
And then he has Ofelia Montesco, who's plays Alejandra. And yeah, I mean, I don't even know like how to begin to tell this story, because essentially the story is about, you know, this guy Julio Joaquin, who buys a haunted house, brings his wife, who he's obviously already having problems with, to the house. And
she also has a heart condition.
Yeah, she has medical conditions. And we later learn that he brought her there to kind of, scare her to death. You know, Mikey, what do you think? How would you describe this story, or like how would you give like your little 1-2 sentence plot?
So about if I were to try to sell this story to someone, like I would just be like, you know, for general audiences, it'd be like, this is like a Edgar Allan Poe type of tale of, you know, kind of like this dark revenge. But it was just kind of like this was my favorite segment of the anthology, too. I really appreciated this first one. I felt it was just kind of like, you know, the guy is basically trying to set up his wife to you know, be scared to death, quote unquote, in this new house and everything, so he can, you know, carry on his life with the mistress and everything. But it's just like, you know, the evilness behind that betrayal kind of gets shifted in a way. And it's okay to spill the spoiler on this, right?
I mean,
yeah. Why not? So basically the the wife kind of I guess like fakes her death and comes back and actually like flips the tables around on her cheating husband, and you know, they all eventually, the people that did the betrayal, the mistress and the husband, end up dying, and the ex-wife, you know, kind of takes everything, packs her stuff and her luggage and everything, and kind of heads out like, you know, you thought you pulled one on me, but the reality is I knew this entire time. Yeah. and had it kind of planned out. And the fucking ghoul costume in this first one is so iconic, and I hope people attach more to that imagery, because I actually really enjoy the costume that they wear in this first one.
It's a big ass mask with long hair, and the hands are, and the chains,
the dragging chain sound in the movie, and like the creaking wood adding to the atmosphere and sound of this first segment. I just was like, yeah, this is fantastic. And it's funny because like you could show people the picture of like the lobby card and say 100 Cries of Terror and show the picture of that ghoul and totally have a different interpretation of what this first segment actually is going to be.
You'd think it's going to be some ghoulish character in there.
Yeah.
But there might be one, because, you know, it's funny because Alex from PRS pointed something out when I was leaving. He was like, did you notice at the end that there's like a hand holding the candle? Right when the woman's leaving, I was like, "Oh yeah, I didn't notice that." He's like, "So I guess there really was a supernatural thing going on."
Oh, I never noticed.
Yeah.
Well, I wonder if that was because you remember there's a scene where, you know, they first walk into the house, and he's obviously like, "Oh well, you know, there's still renovations to be made or whatever," and he's walking, and there's like a dip on the floor boards there. So I wonder if maybe, you know, this whatever demon was probably living underneath in the basement.
So there probably is something really going on there. But it just didn't do anything at the time.
Yeah. Yeah, that's crazy. I got to go back and watch it.
Yeah, it was funny when he pointed that out to me.
It's at the end of the...
Yeah, you know how when she's leaving and then they show like a candle or something like that. And it's like, oh yeah, that's, forget about that. Yeah, I didn't think about that part. Yeah. I have to look again, but I know he mentioned it. I was like, yeah, I didn't notice that before.
Yeah, I didn't notice that. I got to watch
it. There was like, so it's like, okay, so they were hinting that there was something there then for sure. You know, it wasn't all just, you know, a trick or whatever from the husband.
Armando, do you think that the wife actually, you know, knew beforehand, like her whole plan was to get them to this isolated house and kill him?
Or? Yeah, because at the end, remember, she's reading the note and it's, you know, it's narrated by the husband. So it's like she found the note of the plan and everything. So she knew. And then she probably knew the history of the house. So, you know, that was another thing too as well. She already knew what to expect, maybe, of what they might try to do to her.
I intend to mail this letter today, so that it will serve you as a warning. I'm becoming desperate. I can't live without you. I swear that if you don't leave your wife, I'll kill you.
But you know, and to Mikey's point, the character, like the monster of this movie, obviously is the standout, and obviously is the marketing point on this. And I guess, you know, if you go in thinking that this movie is going to be like a monster movie in as a whole without knowing that it's actually a two-part anthology, I can see where people would get a little, I don't know if upset is the word,
but discouraged, a little bit
that, you know, thinking that, you know, it's going to be one way and it actually is something else. So just keep that in mind when you do watch it. But yeah, I mean, the monster, like when he's in the, when they're in the living room and he's talking to his wife, and you can see like the monster, you're right, standing behind the, like outside the house through the window. Like there's some really super creepy images there. And again, I think it lends to just kind of Agustin's work and how he was able to kind of, you know, frame everything inside the camera. But, you know, this is an anthology. So, I mean, it's not, each movie is what, maybe about 35 minutes, maybe 40 minutes at the most.
I think the total runtime on the entire movie was an hour 40.
Yeah, the second one being the longer one.
Yeah,
an hour 40.
I think it was like hour 38.
Yeah, 38 minutes. Yeah.
Shit. Okay.
Yeah, they're really long segments.
Yeah.
Okay, so they're like almost
The first one speeds really good. Like you already start to see everything unravel. The second one, it's like it builds up little by little. So that's why it takes longer.
Yeah. Do you prefer this one over the second movie?
I don't know, honestly. I never thought about that. I always liked both, if anything.
I think the second one was a little bit more like, had a more of an existential type of philosophical like point of view that, you know, it was the, which we'll get into more, but was she real or not? And then this one was just like, I felt like this first one was just in your face, like, oh, here's a betrayal story, and you know, a little bit more easier to digest than the second one.
Yeah, the second one, you really don't know what to expect when you see it for the first time. You're just like, all right, what's gonna happen?
Yeah, so the second, let's get into the second story. It's you know, kind of like you said, like, you know, the stories, like, I mean, I guess I didn't realize they were like 45 minutes each. Yeah, but because not a lot happens in that first one. I mean, it's like we said, you just, you know, get to the house, you know, scares the wife, brings the Sancha in, they end up dying. But the second movie, I felt, to me, the second movie felt way longer. I actually prefer Panico over this second story.
It's called The Crypt of Terror in English, the second one.
Is that what it's called? Because in Spanish, it's called Miedo Supremo, which would be like, supreme fear, like the ultimate fear, I guess.
And then the first one is called A Dead in Panic, A Dead of Panic.
But I mean, yeah.
They have funny titles in English. He was having
people that didn't really speak that, you know. But anyways, yeah, so this second story, like Mikey said, and, you know, I alluded to earlier, it's kind of like an existential crisis, kind of questioning of faith, questioning of death, questioning of life. But, you know, it was shot by Ignacio Torres, who, you know, I don't know why they would have had two different cinematographers for the movie. I don't know if maybe they shot them both, you know, at the same time and just edited them together, which is kind of what I imagine, but I can't say that for sure. But this one was shot by Ignacio Torres, who, you know, prolific in his own way, had almost 130 credits, you know, mainly worked from the golden age period, you know, in the mid 40s up until the late 60s when he died. But he worked with, you know, Gilberto Martinez Solares. He worked with René Cardona, worked with Carlos Enrique Taboada. So he was a very well-established, you know, cinematographer in his own right. And there's not a lot that he could have done with the camera in this story, but there is some shots, like, and I know Mikey said it off air, but, you know, when they're in the crypt and there's like shots of when, you know, you get the perspective of being at the bottom of this crypt, looking up at the stairwell. Like, I mean, there's some really, really good shots in this fucking, in this story too, but very simple plot. It, you know, there's only really two main characters, in the story. The first one is Dr. Javier Medina, who's played by Jorge Martinez de Hoyos. You know, another well-established actor, over 100 credits. He basically acted until the day he died, and he died in 1997, and that was his last credit. But, you know, I think a lot of younger fans would recognize his voice as the narrator in the underseen classic of Guillermo del Toro, Cronos.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Really?
Yeah,
really?
That's right, yeah.
That's
him, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. We won't be talking about Cronos, but he...
I never even heard of it.
You never seen Cronos?
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a pretty rare movie, so...
okay.
But it also stars Alicia Caro, who, you know, her title in the movie is just Mujer del Ataúd, which is just the woman in the crypt or the coffin.
And funny thing is, they actually met, so Jorge and Alicia, they met making this movie, and they ended up having a relationship and got married.
Yeah, they were married until he died. Yeah,
and this was the movie where they first like worked together and met, and it's a romance blossom from there. what a way to start a relationship.
I know, right?
a buried alive movie.
Not really an isolated incident. As we know, we have many actors find love on the set of a movie. And,
this is the most funniest one. That's like, oh, okay. That was cool to learn.
The basic premise of this, as we've kind of been saying, is this guy, Dr. Javier, he shows up to this cemetery to kind of go visit his currently dead wife, goes down into this crypt where they're currently cementing in another body. The fucking bells ring and it's like, oh, that's it. Shift's over, gone, you know? But in the meantime, he kind of, he passes out and he gets locked up into this crypt with a dead body. And I guess my question to you guys is, do you think that she was actually dead in this movie and she was just kind of an apparition to him, or was she actually buried alive? What do you think?
That's a hard one, actually, because it's so hard to tell. Like, I think it was just all interpretation. Like, I think it was all just all in his head, though, if anything. But it's so hard to tell because, you know, they do at the end show him trying to, like, you know, fix everything that was destroyed. But then it's like, well, we don't even know if that was real.
Yeah. I mean, he could have been, you know, imagining that that was his wife's crypt as well. That's, you know,
that was another thing. Yeah. He was still like in mourning, you know.
Yeah. That's exactly what, like, my interpretation was of this one. Because, you know, this one runs a little bit slower. It's a little bit more more dialogue and stuff. And I felt it was more of like, you know, reflection of his past wife. And I actually felt like this segment, like, was kind of like touching on communication issues between male and female, in a way, because he does snap at some point also too. And it's just like, I felt like maybe that this was like him dragging possible stuff from the past, and kind of like, this is where it's like so weird. It could be psychological, and it's just up into interpretation, because there's no real definitive answer to this. It's just like, well, what do you interpret from this? It could be that she's just an actual person that's alive, or just dead. And it's just like, there's really no answers to this movie. And I felt like this one was more of the harder one to kind of interpret compared to the first segment.
And the thing is, that does happen, especially back in the day. You would hear about, like, people getting buried alive, or they think they're dead but then they're not dead.
Yeah,
so that could have been an incident too that happened.
Yeah, I mean, you brought up a good point where he snaps at her a lot. Like, he's very aggressive with her, because she, you know, when we see her out of this coffin, she's kind of unaware of what's actually happening. And there's actually, you know, I'm kind of glad you said that, because it reminded me of a shot where the camera was inside the mausoleum, like in her crypt, I guess, looking out. And she was already outside of her coffin, standing out in, you know, in kind of like the little standing area with him. But she's kind of, I don't want to say manic, but she's very, what's the word I'm looking for? She's very sensitive to, like, noises that are happening inside. She's nervous about the darkness. And I'm sure that can be an interpretation to kind of.
And remember, there's like a little turtle. Remember that little girl that by accident? Yeah, exactly. And then she got super freaked out by the turtle, too.
I mean, everything. I mean, there was like a plank of wood that fell. She, you know, she freaked out.
Yeah, everything.
There weren't enough candles to light up the, you know, the crypt at night. So she was freaking out about that. And he gets pretty aggressive with her, to the point where, you know, you actually thought that he might actually hit her and harm her.
Yeah.
I was right. Another wick has been extinguished. They're coming nearer now. They're extinguishing all the torches.
Come back here. You mustn't think about it.
They're in here. I know they are. They're after me.
It's logical. The humidity of the crypt is coming toward us from that direction. These pots here are the last ones to be affected by it. That's why they're the last ones to go out. It's plain, pure logic. Don't you understand?
Don't lie to me. They're doing it. They're in here. They're closing it to take me back with them.
Don't talk nonsense. You must reason.
Let me go. Let go of me. They're coming after me. It's as dark in here as it was inside the casket. You've got to stop them. They're coming after me. They're going to put me back inside that horrible coffin.
Calm down. You've got to get a hold of yourself.
So that actually is a pretty good, you know, a good call out there about, you know, communication between, and maybe it was some kind of, you know, history between this guy and his wife. Yeah. Maybe that was, you know, his wife's, you know, spirit coming back in the form of a zombie. And
And that's the thing, it's never explained. It's never explained with anything. You know, you just, all you know is he's mourning his ex-wife, but you don't know if, like, there's regret involved with that mourning, or there's like remorse for stuff that could have happened, because we don't know the whole extent or story. And like, you know, people, you know, you take your baggage sometimes into other relationships and stuff like that, or how you communicate with others. And it just felt like there was, like I said, it's all just interpretation of like how yeah. do you, I feel like sometimes though, when you like thinking it from this point of view, it's just, you know, it's just kind of like you're filling in the gaps and projecting a little bit when it's like there's nothing really there to work with. I don't know.
Yeah, well, that's kind of the problem with this movie is that or this segment, I should say, is that there are a lot of blanks. And because it is a two story narrative, you don't really have a full 90 minutes to fledge out all of the internal monologue that this guy would have been having and kind of setting things up. Because he shows up to this fucking cemetery like 20 minutes before it's closing time. Yeah. It's like, okay, well, if you really cared, you would have showed up earlier. Like, yeah. What the fuck are you doing?
Yeah. I don't know, but that is good though. Then. There's a lot of interpretation. So when you watch this movie or if you've seen it, yeah, I really want to hear you guys tell me what you guys think. Yeah. You need to tell us.
Yeah.
I want to hear other interpretations.
And like we keep telling you guys, you know, hit yeah. us up. We want to create dialogue about these yeah. movies. Because if you look this one up, and I guess this is kind of will lend into the next question that I wanted to ask both of you guys, is that, you know, this is kind of a rare underseen movie. You know, when I looked it up on Letterboxd, there was less than 200 views logged on it.
Oh wow.
With that terrible DVD cover.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
I'm gonna fix that. I'm gonna fix that after the show. By the way,
I was literally texting Armando this week, being like, you know, I was looking up of like what releases has this movie had, and the dollar store one that I saw.
Oh yeah, with the faces. God. Yeah,
yeah, so bad. And it's just like you can look at it and you're like, oh, this was like a Big Lots 25-cent like last chance clearance type of DVD.
Yeah, I have that one. I bought it at the 99-cent store a long time ago.
That's you bought funny. It at Pick and Save, yo.
Yeah, literally, like at the dollar store. They used to have that one a lot.
Wow.
Well, that's kind of a shame because this movie deserves way more than that. You know, the stories are very basic, but I think there is a lot that, you know, as we kind of alluded to, like there's a lot to interpret in these movies if you really want to look deep inside, you know, the narrative. But, you know, my question to both of you, and, you know, I guess we can start with Armando, is where do you think this movie stands in the, you know, the lexicon of Mexican horror movies because of how underseen it is?
I mean, when you think about Mexican horror of that era, you just think monsters, vampires,
yeah. like pulpy
stuff, yeah, you know, all yeah. that stuff that everybody obviously really likes, and I like it too. But, you know, there's still more layers of horror than just stuff like that. You know, there's your psychological horror, you know, stuff like that. And this is kind of falls into that category. I think a lot of this is a lot of psychological stuff in here. But a lot of people aren't really into it. That's the thing. That's the thing that I really, like, kind of get annoyed with people. I'm sorry to say. Like, some people just don't like psychological stuff, as they should. They always want just the straight-in-your-face horror, you know? Yeah. Fucking, like, Art the Clown type of shit. You know, it's like, I don't give a fuck about seeing a clown killing people. I want to see why this person's doing it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, if I want to see Art the Clown, I want to know why is Art the Clown the way he is. But they don't even fucking tell you, because they don't care. They just want to see him doing stuff.
Yeah, so, for the record, I think Terrifier fucking sucks.
Yeah. So that's what I'm trying to say. So that's an example of what I'm trying to say. It's like people want to just see stuff like that. They want to see the vampires. They want to see the Frankensteins. But it's like, well, what about like the people that are not crazy or ugly like that? What if they're just regular people dealing with everyday life stuff, you know? Like mourning deaths or betraying their spouses and trying to get their monies and stuff. It's like that stuff's real life. It's scary too, you know? That's actually really scary shit too.
And like yeah. going back, and you know what I was talking about earlier about the advertising for this movie, especially on the lobby cards and stuff, is like presenting it as a, you know, some kind of ghoul or monster, and when it's like actually not that,
not even all. That it's ironic, but yeah, but that's the selling point.
Yeah.
The monster, as we learn, is our people.
Yeah,
it's like, you know what, there is really no monster. The yeah. real monsters is just us inside.
And just wanted to compliment too, because you know, when you gave Hope the poster to restore it, that was like one of the cleanest posters you yeah. have given her. And I was like, man, yeah. this looks sick, dude.
Yeah, like nobody has, like, you could tell it was probably never even used. When I first got it, I remember when I opened it, I was like, oh, this has never been used.
It was beautiful. It was, like, yeah. it was beautiful, and like, you know, there was no staining or wear on it. And I was mm-hmm. like, wow, dude, this is like literally like a, what, almost 60-year-old poster at this point?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I got it, I was like, oh, wow, it's even better than I thought. You know, I was expecting the usual wear and tear.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Shit, it is 60 years.
Yeah.
Huh? Yeah, it's
this
just
would be the 60th year.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Well, I mean, what are your kind of closing thoughts? Like, where do you think this stands in kind of the world of Mexican horror movies?
I think this is, like, you know, touching on what Armando was saying, a lot of, like, even recently just getting the Indicator Mexico box set of stuff, and it is, like, you know, it's these people are chasing these creature type of things, and like I said, with the advertising, it kind of like sells it to you as this is going to be like a haunted ghoul type of monster, maybe chasing around people and everything like that, and the reality is it is not that type of movie at all, and it just felt very different from what I've seen. And I think that's what kind of like drew me to this movie a little bit more. It was just like, you know, I'm usually not an anthology guy. Like, I'm not huge on anthology.
Yeah, they're hit or miss.
Yeah, very hit or miss. Like, that's what I was going to say too.
Like, even with stuff with like Creepshow, I'm just like, it's cool. But I'm not like, oh my God, anthology. Like, I love this. But I thought this was probably my favorite one that I've seen beyond like, you know, Tales from the Crypt, the 70s British one and stuff. So it was, I think it was awesome because, you know, bringing an anthology aspect like that. And it felt, like I said before, it felt like very like Edgar Allan Poe type of like cautionary tales of like delving into like the darkness of the psyche and everything like that when it, you know, people wanted monster stuff. I don't know. I thought this is great. I hope more people can actually see a really good version of this.
Yeah, there's shitty versions on YouTube, and I'm sure wherever else you guys want to try to find it. But again, that version on YouTube is
garbage.
It's pretty bad. Yeah, the audio is terrible. The image isn't even straight. It's like crooked,
washed out.
Yeah, super washed out. Yeah, fucking, you know, blurry as shit. I do think that this movie deserves more credit than it currently has, and I'm sure once people start to discover it and find it and watch it, you know, it'll kind of explode in kind of the world of Mexican horror movies, because as both of you guys said, and I agree completely, you know, this movie doesn't deal with monsters, and if you want to quantify it as it does, you know, the monsters are as humans, right? So that's kind of the basic of both of these stories, is that, you know, humans are at the forefront, and it's really the scariest part of the movie is, you know, kind of what these humans are either doing to each other or doing to themselves. And I know that's not something that, especially for this era, you know, that Mexican horror is kind of known for. But, you know, it really, you know, kind of dives into, you know, social issues of Mexico at the time, I think.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. 100%.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you have a chance to watch it, you know, you should have came to the couple screenings that these fools had. And if you didn't, you fucked up. Yeah. What can I say?
I don't know. We'll figure something out. We'll probably play it again or something, or like I told Mike, we'll probably just dupe it on Blu-ray or something. I don't know. We'll do something. But you guys better watch it.
You better watch it, and you better support, because if they do put it out, there's no better way to watch it than this print. You know, granted, it is an English dub, so you get a little bit of that cheapness. But
and if you're watching movies on YouTube, I think you need to see a doctor. If you're watching movies on YouTube like that, like with that really bad quality, there's something really wrong with you.
Like, honestly, like sometimes, like, I just, like, I know some stuff, you're just like, you know, this is the only way you're going to be able to find it or whatever. It's like this shitty rip and everything, but it's like, do you want to, like, even though this is the only way you're going to watch it, it's just like not even enjoyable at that point. Like, it's like, I don't know. It's even, it feels like, like a fourth generation VHS dupe, like down to that point where it's so washed out that it's just like this is shadows.
This is all just pixels at this point. Yeah, it's not even videos. It's just pixels.
Well, this is a huge digression here, but what kind of responsibility do you think these, you know, quote unquote boutique labels have to kind of restore these type of movies? I mean, granted this movie in particular is pretty criminally underseen, but, you know, why do you think companies, let's say, I don't want to call companies out by name, but You know, why wouldn't some of these companies want to jump on this movie? It, you know, is it rights issues? Is it, you know, because it's a public domain movie? Is it, you know, is there not enough fan demand for it? What do you guys
think? It's just like I told you before. People just want in your face shit. They want to see the monster, the killer. They don't care about the stories or anything like that. Anything serious.
And I will admit to this, because I was one of these people where if something was in black and white, I would kind of push it to the side.
Yeah,
that's another thing. Yeah. There's less interest of people wanting to see black and white films.
Like even with some of the tours and stuff that, you know, touring around Prince and everything like that, you know, I'd be so excited with the black and white stuff. Like one of my favorite things that I did was The Violent Years and Teenage Crime Wave. I was like a criminal yeah, black and white devil. The Violent Years
is fucking dope.
Yeah, and it's like, I was like so excited. I'm like, oh, this is like my favorite double I've done. And you know, you play something like this and like 12 people come out and you're just kind of like, wait, but this is the thing I was most excited about. And it's just like, it's hard to get people excited for black and white stuff or to even give it a chance. And I was ignorant like that at one point. And I think, you know, watching a bunch of more like noir and stuff with Hope, it's really like opened me up to being like, hey, this shit's actually like really good. And like, I think in the last few years, I've been more open to black and white stuff these days.
Oh, yeah. You got to give the old stuff a chance.
Yeah.
Color, no color. You have to give it a chance.
What about sound? No sound? You into silent movies?
No, I haven't hit that. I haven't hit that yet.
He just started watching black and white.
I'm easing it. I just barely started like, you know, we've been revisiting a lot of like, you know, the older type of like 30s, 40s cinema with like these grand dancing schemes and everything. And it's like, I was never open to this stuff. And I'm like watching it. And I'm like, oh, I see why people still talk about it today. Like this stuff is actually pretty good.
Yeah. I think there's a lane for everybody. I myself am also not really, especially when it comes to like the 30s, 40s, 50s is kind of pushing it for me. Not because I don't particularly like it. It's just that I just don't really, I don't know. I don't really go back that far. But, you know, there's movies for everybody. And I'm glad that there's at least someone talking about, you know, whatever style of a movie that people want to watch. Because if not, then, you know, those movies will die. You know, the actors will die. The legacy of those, you know, artists will die.
Yeah. And then if you're a fan of Ramon Obon's movies, you know, like Vampiro and all that, you have to see Hunter Cries of Terror.
Yeah.
If you really respect him as a writer and then him only directing his movie, it's like, you have to see this. You have to see what else he had to offer before he died. Cause this is literally like his last movie ever.
Yeah, and you know, like, you know, exactly to Armando's point. I mean, a lot of people praise his work that he's done as a writer,
but they only want to praise, you know, the stuff that everybody already knows.
Yeah,
you got to give his other stuff a chance, even his film noirs and dramas.
Really, but again, I think that also lends into, and I don't want to, you know, point blame at any company, but I do think that these companies have a responsibility to expand their reach with certain movies. You know, that I mean, it's easy for me to say as a fan and not, you know, as part of being in the industry, in the business, you know, to, you know, have to pay money to release these movies that maybe people don't want to watch. Maybe, you know, maybe they don't even know they want to watch these movies, but you know, you got to give them a chance, you know, because eventually these movies are going to fucking disappear. You know, look how hard it was for this fool Mikey to find a 16 millimeter print just to keep it, you know, in circulation and surviving. You know, if, you know, who knows what would happen if some other bozo would have came and bought the lot and been like, what the fuck is this? And just tossed it, you know, then you would have been stuck with either no prints or a shitty print.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, I'm just ranting, but, you know, seek these movies out. They are enjoyable. This movie is really good. I don't want to speak for, you know, these two guys here, but, you know, I can almost guarantee that the majority of people will enjoy this movie, either both stories or one or the other.
Yeah. And like I said, everybody that's told me that I've seen it or that I've came to the screening, they all loved it. They all had really good things to say about it. They never once said it was just okay. It was always just like, it was really good.
Yeah.
Or it was okay. Like, nope, nothing like that. It was always, it was good.
And you missed out if you didn't come to any of the screenings. Like,
they fucked up.
Yeah.
People are weird. Y'all want to go see Terrifier Part 5 or whatever.
Meanwhile, that fool is like in a you know in a new lawsuit right now. Whatever. I don't want to talk about
yeah. this. But you know what I mean. I'm just saying, like, people need to give other things a chance. If they really want to see horror, you have to see all aspects of horror, not just what you're familiar with or what you think is the only good stuff.
But it's like, what chance do you get, really? Like, even here in LA, to like see a Mexican movie on actual film. Like, even here in LA or outside or anywhere, it's just like, I don't know, those type of things. I'm like, yeah, this doesn't come up. And that's the type of stuff that I'm attracted to when it comes to going to screenings. It's like, oh, you're not going to see this again for like maybe another 5 to 10 years if it even comes up. And it's just like, you go and relish in those moments of stuff. And I felt like these screenings were kind of that. And yeah, hopefully we find more prints and hopefully we can place. Hopefully some more stuff in 2026 on actual film.
Yeah, that's the goal. Hopefully. I'm hoping you guys find more prints because, you know, the crowd needs it, man. You know, especially now. There's kind of been a resurgence, or not, I don't know if resurgence is the word, but kind of an influx of, you know, Hispanic, Latin, whatever you label yourself, viewers that are going to movies now, you know, like they actually want to seek it out. Granted, you know, I don't know how often they're going to see, you know, Mexican movies or South American movies or Latin American movies, but, you know, I think the more, you know, these type of movies screen, I think the bigger the audience is going to get. And I think that will, you know, hopefully will start to create a demand for labels to release these kind of movies.
That's what I always try to tell people. If you see stuff like this playing, you have to support it, because then we're not going to get anything later.
I miss Santo Sundays, man.
Just like, and so just, did a lot of that, people. That's like that's like a perfect example. It's like, who was playing Santo movies before? Not really. Like, I know Viviana had screenings here and there, but then it's like a whole marathon.
We did 4 fucking months.
Yeah, and I'm just saying, and then now after that, I'm not going to call out anybody, but it's like, then all of a sudden people wanted to show Lucha stuff.
Yeah.
But it's cool, though. But either way, it's like, hey, at least it encouraged people to at least put it out more, you know? Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. Like, if you see stuff like that, yeah, like, create a demand for it. Yeah, if it's not going to be, at least do it yourself if you can, you know?
And the screenings went well at Frida. Like, they kept every screening kept going up more and more.
Oh, yeah.
And I was actually very surprised by it, and it's just the response to that again. And if we ever get the chance again to do that, maybe in 2026, that would be fantastic.
Oh yeah, for sure. That's what I'm trying to say.
2026, man, the year of Trash Mag See It on 16 film revival. Book it. I'm calling it now. 2026, big year.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, let's wind it down here. You know, any upcoming shows that you want to promote? This is gonna be live on starting this Monday. So anything past this Monday, shout it out.
So what's happening this past Monday? I mean, this Monday coming up for the rest of November is Sleep. Eat, watch movies. I'm taking the next 4 weeks off, and I'm staying home. I don't have to go back to projecting until December 5th. December, finishing off the year with It's a Wonderful Life matinees, and then also touring a 16mm print of Black Christmas from Bob Clark, and then this one tripped out fucking movie from Sanrio called
Nutcracker Fantasy.
Yeah, I think it's Fantasy Nutcracker.
Fantasy.
It sounds like it can be a porno title name or something too. Yeah, if you mix them up.
Yeah, that one I'm gonna see for sure. Yeah.
So Sanrio put this out. I'm gonna be doing, I think, 2 shows with Alex from PRS, and we're gonna be touring that print around Art Theater Long Beach and PRS. That's pretty much it, and then just enjoying the holidays and having downtime, man, because it's been crazy. It just this we were counting everything, and within the last 3-4 years of all this, I've done close to over 350 shows now, and I'm just like, it's catching up with me. I'm getting a lot more gray hairs now.
So. I didn't want to say it, but I'm like, damn.
Yeah, nah, dude.
At least you still have hair, man. I lost mine, you know, and it didn't take 300 screenings for me. All right, well, you know, you heard it here. If you see it on 16 coming to a theater near you, go fucking support that shit, man. Don't be a lame. Don't be a fool made of plastic, man. Go show up, support. You know, as far as for the podcast. December is going to be, I mean, personally, I think it's going to be a great episode.
I even put the poster up.
Yeah, I saw that. I've been preparing, you know, and I want to say it now because I know people are going to think it, but this has been in the, this episode has been in the works for about a year now. That we've been talking about it.
Yeah, you know? That's true.
So it's not because of newfound popularity that's going on right now.
Yeah, it actually intertwined with that.
Yeah, I know. I'm completely shocked. I didn't even know that that special was happening.
Yeah, I forgot that was coming out, yeah.
We have that in December. January, we haven't booked it yet, but we, you know, hopefully we'll have a guest in. We're just working on trying to get a scheduling for that. February, of course, we're gonna have an
February. Yeah, I already planned February.
Yeah, Armando programmed the February show where we're gonna talk about lovers, yeah, cheaters, side pieces.
We'll try to get somebody for that one. I someone that we already had before. We'll try to get them back. Yeah,
and then of course March we're gonna have our annual episode of Las Bellas de Trash Mex, where we're going to highlight the women of Trash Mex.
Yeah, so the podcast isn't going nowhere. We're going to keep going, and we're going to always bring something different, you know, something new every month. It's not going to be what you expect. It's always going to be something new and unexpected.
So tune in, because you don't want to be late to the train, man, because, you know, by the time we hit mega stardom, you know.
I don't know about mega stardom.
We rulers of the podcast.
Oh,
world.
Yeah. We know our shit, man. Nah, I'm just joking. We still have to figure stuff out. We're always learning, you know, as we go. There's stuff that I'm always learning as we go as well. You know?
I mean, that's the whole point.
I'm never going to tell people I'm an expert. It's like, no, I just, you know, I read about it. You know, like I look at shit up, you know. People like to think, you know, you think you know it. I was like, no, actually, I don't.
I'm glad you guys are actually doing this, because this is something that was like back and forth for a while of just like, come on, dude. Like, you know, people would love to hear you talk about stuff. And it's just like, now that you guys are what, almost over a year into it already. And it's just like, no, I was happy to see it.
Funny enough, we had sitting in the back of an Uber, me and Armando had a conversation at the Texas when we went to go screen this, me trying to convince him, come on, man, let's fucking do this. That's goddamn right. Podcast. Yeah. So it goes back far, man. Yes, it took me a while to convince Armando to do it. As you guys already know the story, but you know, stay in tune, you know, as Armando said, we're still learning as well. You know, no one here is an expert. Except Armando, I guess, is you know, can be quantified.
I don't have a life. You guys know that already. I'm literally always home, and then, I mean, I got a girl now, so the girl's here. But even then, when she's here, I'm here like.
Yeah, I'm
still trying to find stuff, you know.
Hey, yeah. You know, always on the search. You know, always trying to educate ourselves. You know, of course. It all started with the Trash Mex website, so don't forget that website still exists.
There's I got a bunch of shit coming, a lot of stuff coming in. So keep an eye out.
15 years strong at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So I got check new that stuff out. Coming, and then what else we got? We got other stuff. I mean, there's gonna be other stuff.
There's merch on there. You know, fucking support. You know, buy a damn T-shirt. Yeah.
And most of all, you know, comment, subscribe. Podcast,
follow along.
We're on all platforms, you know, all the preferred ones.
If I can write us on Letterboxd, write us on Instagram, we're on Letterboxd, email us.
Yeah,
you've been getting Letterboxd famous these days. Man,
bro, that shit's whack.
Oh no, it's not October anymore.
I'm still on there.
You're still a featured.
They haven't changed that shit yet. I'm still getting followers.
Damn. Hey, you know, shout out to that. Shout out to Letterboxd, I guess. You know.
Well, I don't know now.
Comment on his Letterboxd. Your Letterboxd 4 on Armando's comments. You know, let him know.
Yeah.
Maybe you'll get chosen at some point.
Right. Oh, maybe they did change it. I don't. Yeah, I haven't had a follower since yesterday. But look at all the followers. Look at all the shit I had. Over.
That's when you know it's bad, when all the people have like no images. It's just like the stock profile picture.
This guy bought some bots, and he's just like, I don't know why these people are
following. No, I'm not
paid for productivity on that.
I'm not like other podcasts, quote unquote.
It's always free, guys. That was the main thing that Armando and I talked about. This show will always be free. It'll always be available.
Yeah, so don't think you have to subscribe or pay for anything.
No, never. you know, if you ever want to pay us, you know, just send us on Venmo some money anyways. But
Venmo, or I don't know, buy us snacks. I don't
know. No, the best way to support us is to listen, tell everybody, tell your tías, your tíos, your Sancho, your ex, your wife, anyone you hate, anyone you love. Just spread the word, you know, watch the movies, engage with us, you know, teach us something, you know, come to the shows, you know, support Mikey and See It on 16. That's the best way to support, is to just show up and talk, really.
Yeah, and if you see us, don't be afraid. Come up to us. I don't know how many times I've had people say, oh, I saw you. I mean, you saw me, but you didn't say hi.
Yeah, it happens all the time, man.
You saw me? What?
Do you think we're unapproachable sometimes?
No, I'm like right there. Even
at the merch table at the show, do you think we give off of like...
We're literally there for whatever, if people want to buy stuff or not. I mean, that's the whole point, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. People are just shy. I think that's just really what it is. I never realized how shy people are.
It's easier to talk to someone online than it is
exactly, for a lot of
people.
So. Exactly.
You know, I kind of get that way sometimes too, but you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. If you see Mike, say hi to him. He's always there. If you see me somewhere, say hi. Don't be weird. Don't make it weird, and don't message her either. That makes it even more weird.
I remember there. This is. I'll tell this story off air. This doesn't need to be. This is the end. Here's the trailer for the next month episode. We will have a guest. You've heard him before, so. Be prepared for that, you know, and that's all there is to say.
You think this one's gonna get 1,000 downloads too?
So that's one thing. Our last episode on Los Bukis, that was back in December, it crossed 1,000 downloads. So I just, anyone who's listened to it, downloaded it, or told anyone about that show specifically, thank you. That was a joke that I came to Armando with, who Armando said, fuck yeah, let's do it. And who knew that was going to be the best, most downloaded Trash Mechs podcast episode.
This one will probably beat it then for sure.
We'll see.
Another music one.
It's another music one, yeah. And I'm sure with that hint, you'll guess who it is. But we'll see you guys next month, or we'll talk to you guys next month. Tune in, man. Follow along. Yeah. Tell everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Have a good one.
Peace.
Próximamente estrenaremos.
¿Ha vuelto el estómago?
Dos veces.
Bueno, eso le ayudará. Cualquier cosa que se le ofrezca, avíseme, no se preocupe.
Muchísimas gracias, doctor. Pincha Dan. ¿Cómo te pones a hacer estas cosas? Hasta calentura te dio. Eso déjalo para uno que está acostumbrado a andar desbalagada. Pero tú, pincha Dan. Ya ni la jodes.
Perdóname, Meche. Es que me agarró el miedo. La desesperación de que nunca la voy a hacer. De que mis canciones no valen la pena. Que a nadie le gusta cómo canto. Que todos me dan por mi lado nada más por pasar el rato.
Estás loco, pinche Adán. Tú la vas a hacer. No más que vayas a México y te oigan tu material, vas a acabar con todos. Estás muy chavalillo todavía. Pero óyeme bien, tus rolas valen mucho. Y como vuelvas a hacer otra onda como la de anoche, te voy a madrear. Yo creí que casi te ibas a morir. Y luego yo, de tres veces, ya, horrible. Pinchada, no me vuelvas a dar otro susto como esto, carajo.